It's 8:30. We can start. Erev Tov, everybody. Nice to see everybody. I guess a new cycle of the Chumash. So hopefully, we can get into it and lots to learn. The goal here, I don't have every week planned out yet. It's really to have different people give this Parsha Shir. This sort of a little bit, I think, something interesting. Get different people every Thursday. But in the meantime, we'll start on Bereshit in the beginning. So what I want to do, at least for most of this year, is to discuss what type of a book the Torah is. I called it an introduction, a biblical introduction. What exactly? You open up the Chumash. So you have to know what exactly are you reading? Different types of genres of literature. You read them in a different way, depending on what it is. And a science book, a history book, a book of literature, fiction, nonfiction, are parts of the Torah fiction. I know that sounds like a crazy question, but we'll get there. But the Rambam does say that parts of it are, quote, fiction, not like meaning, but not exact. It's for sure not literal. So I want to discuss some of the aspects of what the Torah is and then try to give a little bit of an overview on the book of on Bereshit. And okay, so I guess I'll start at the end, which means that the 613th mitzvah is the way the rabbis understood the mitzvah is to write a Sefer Torah, that every Jew has an obligation to write their own personal Sefer Torah. Without getting into the legal whole discussion now, it's generally assumed that that mitzvah has basically changed because basically the mitzvahs have a Jewish library. When the Torah was written, you weren't allowed to write down any other books. The only book that could be written was the written Torah. And the purpose, the Torah itself says, the purpose of the mitzvah, b'lamda b'nei Yisrael, you should teach it to the Jewish people. So that was the old way to teach. Today we teach on Zoom. Today we teach with books and the internet, the printing press. So it's generally assumed there is no particular mitzvah to write your own Sefer Torah. I've mentioned it on many occasions that I'm, as an aside, you don't have to agree with me, I'm not a big fan of people dedicating a Sefer Torah. I don't want to insult anybody, God forbid. It's a nice thing to do, but I really think there's so many, Sefer Torah that are not in use. I think I mentioned this before, some Pastora, that we don't need them. We need to put the money into Jewish education, into a live Sefer Torah. But be that as it may, that's the last mitzvah of the Torah. Now, really, what the Torah there is talking about is Hazinu. At the end of the Torah, the Hazinu Hashemayim Vadabir is written as a poem in the Torah. That and as Yashir. If you open up a Sefer Torah, it's written not like just straight block letters. There's gaps and spaces. And if it's not written that way, the Sefer Torah is actually invalidated. Our rabbis understood that the word, although in the context of the Chumash, the simple meaning of the Chumash is that the Shira refers to Hazinu, it's actually a reference to the entire Torah. The entire Torah is a song. So what does that mean? That so the Torah self-defines itself as a song. So maybe I'll start with the Netziv has a beautiful explanation. Maybe some of you have heard it before. Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. He was the great Rosh Yeshiva and the Valazhin Yeshiva. That's the Harvard of all yeshivot, so to speak, the mother of all yeshivot, founded in 1803 by Rav Chaim of Valazhin, sort of the top student of the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon sent all his students to the land of Israel. The Vilna Gaon died in 1797, and he encouraged his top students to make Aliyah, which is why, by the way, when you go to Israel, they always hear it. We here follow the minhag of the Gra. They don't say Baruch Hashem l'olam amein v'amein at Marv or v'shamru on Friday night before Shmoneh Esrei. It has nothing to do with the land of Israel. It has to do with the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon's practice was not to say it. Israel was basically virgin territory. There were very few Jews. So the people who came in the early 1800s established whatever customs they wanted. So it was the students of the Vilna Gaon. So they established his customs. In Vilna, they didn't take the customs of the Vilna Gaon because they had other customs for hundreds of years. They weren't going to let the Vilna Gaon change. Anyways, his students go to Israel. The Vilna Gaon, Rav Chaim of Valazhin stays behind, opens up Yeshivat Eitz Chaim in 1803. And that becomes the model of all modern day yeshivot in many ways. And the Netziv is the Rosh Yeshiva for the last 39 years or so. The yeshiva closes in 1892, I believe, pressure by the Russian government. That's not for now. But the Netziv did something very unusual today for a Rosh Yeshiva, is that he gave it a daily shiur in Parshat HaShavua. He would speak in the yeshiva today, you know, sort of looked down upon. The Rosh Yeshivas only teach, you know, Talmud. And his commentary or his comments is written up in the commentary Emek Davar. And it's, you know, some very beautiful, insightful, modern comments. The Netziv was not university educated. I don't think he spoke Russian, as far as I know. I don't believe, but maybe someone can correct me on that. Why did I mention all this? So in his introduction to the Chumash, he describes why is the Torah called a Shira? Why is the Torah Shira? And he says, well, a Shira means a poem. It means a song, but he interprets it to mean a poem. And then he says, why is the Torah a poem? It's not written like a poem. It doesn't rhyme. Doesn't look like a poem, except for maybe Az Yashir. Doesn't look like a poem. So what makes it a poem? So he says, first of all, he says one cute thing that's for any of, for those, you know, I remember my, when we looked, you know, in high school, in English literature class, you take, you know, poetry, like, you know, most people find the kind of uninteresting and boring and it doesn't, what is the poem, what's the time, but you have to work hard. You have to work hard to understand a poem. He says, you have to work hard to understand the Chumash. A poem, you read a novel, it's easy reading. You can read it in bed. If you read a poem to really understand it, you have to work hard to understand. That's A. B, of course, and that's related, the main meaning of the poem is not what's written. It's between the lines. The main part of a poem is obviously what to read between the lines, not the lines themselves. And that's what the Torah is. You know, so many things we have in the Torah. Where does it say that in the Torah? It doesn't say in the Torah. You have to know how to read between the lines. They asked Rav Soloveitchik very once, you know, where does he get all these unbelievable insights? So he said he knows how to read between the lines. He reads the Gemara. Other people read the same Gemara. They don't see what he sees. If you practice a lot, if you know something inside out, 101 times, as it says in the Talmud, to review 101 times, then you get to read, to learn between the lines. So that's, the Torah is read between the lines. Number three, we know that in a poem, the poet often wants to have the names rhyme. He wants to have sonnets, 14 lines. You know, a poem's got to be exactly 14 lines. It's got to have his name, you know, the first line of every initial, like in the Chatzot, the Shlomo Alkabet, you know, that's Shlomo Halevi. People put their names, Elazar HaKalir does that all the time. People put their names in the poet. So God does the same thing, so to speak, in the Torah. We often change the language a little bit. It doesn't always read straight because you want to get an additional idea and you want to highlight a second message. So that's a very common technique of the Torah. We're not going to go into so many examples. I mean, as you can see, this obviously you can spend, there's a lot to do here, but just conceptually, I think it's a very beautiful idea. The other thing of great poetry, of course, is it stands the test of time. We study Shakespeare and we study, we study the great poets hundreds of years ago and thousands of years ago. And I know you'll say Shakespeare isn't a poet exactly, but you know, honestly, great literature stands the test of time, great poetry. And just like the Torah does, and perhaps most important is we know that in a poem, there are always various interpretations. In a great poem, you can understand that, you know, scholars, they still debate what is what things mean in Shakespeare. I mean, great books, even a novel can occasionally do that. What's the deeper meaning? And the Torah, of course, lends itself to various interpretations, which can be contradictory and can yet be both correct at the same time. So that, then, Steve has this beautiful introduction. Like I say, he didn't go to college. He didn't, you know, but as a self-taught person, he was quite a fascinating, you know, person. All great people are fascinating. That's the Netziv's understanding. When the Torah says, so the entire Torah has to be read as a poem. Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim et ha-aretz is read as a poem. What's the Torah? It's not telling us, why is the Torah telling us God created the world? What's the meaning? And we'll see some examples of different interpretations, hopefully a little later on. But that's the first idea of... The Netziv says, Rashi doesn't explicitly say this, but this I mentioned before, it's come up other times. Rashi basically interprets Shira as a song, not as a poem. In other words, I would say that Rashi claims the Torah is a love poem. It's God's love poem of the Jewish people. We say that all the time. God loves us. He gave us the Torah. It's a wedding. Yassis alayich alohayich. The relationship between God and the Jewish people are like a chatan and a kala. We say that all the time. So it's not, that's in a sense kind of obvious, but the Torah is God's love poem of the Jewish people. And Rashi, I've written about this, whatever, and Rashi, if you look in each one of the opening comments of Bereshit, Shmot, Vayikra, Bamidbar, and Dvarim, Rashi talks about God's love of the Jewish people. Why does the Torah begin at Bereshit? Because God wanted to give us the land of Israel, right? He loves us. He created a special land. What's special about the land of Israel? So the Torah tells us what's special about the land of Israel is the eyes of God are focused on the land of Israel. That's a verse in the Torah. Poetry. I have to understand what exactly does it mean. Not literal. The eyes of God are focused on the land of Israel from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. So that's special. The Israel is the place where the divine presence dwells the greatest. And therefore, he gave a special land to the special people he loves. That's basically what Rashi's saying. In Bereshit, I think it was Abba Ibn, or was it when Netanyahu? I think it was Abba Ibn. Maybe it was when Netanyahu was the ambassador to the UN. They quoted this Rashi at the UN, you know, podium when they're having all the fights, you know, about Israel. Okay, I don't, it doesn't really work. I remember when I was learning in the Gris Kollel and why use Kollel in Israel. So we were, it's next door to Michlala. If you know, in Beit Vegan, they're down the hill. So the Gris Kollel, and so the first week that all the Michlala girls came, we were a little bit older. We were like 23, 24. We were in the Smicha program, the 18-year-old girls at Michlala. So they didn't have, they make them all stay in for Shabbos, and they wanted to have a minyan, but they weren't going to send the girls over. So they asked the Kollel guys to come to Michlala to make the minyan. So it was nice. We were like behind the mechitza, because they were like 10 guys and like 150 girls. So we had this little, you know, section. And Rav Cooperman, who was the long time, the founder, had Michlala, so I remember, was Parshat Bereshit. So Rav Cooperman spoke on this Rashi, on, you know, here, can you imagine in France in the 11th century, Rashi writing this, you know, that the Torah begins at Bereshit to tell us that we have a right to the land of Israel. And he said, of course, what's not written for the non-Jews so much, it's written maybe also, but the religious non-Jews. But for us as a Jewish people to recognize that. So that's what Rashi opens up Bereshit. Nu Shmot, what does Rashi say in Shmot? Why is Eile Shmot ben Israel? Abim Mitzrayim, Ruben, we know all this. It's all repetition. Where he says God loves the Jewish people. He counts them. He wants to mention them all the time. When you love something, you talk about them a lot of times. So that's why it's repetitious. Vayikra, Vayikra, that's a beautiful word, to call out an endearment. Vayikar with Bilam, like it's haphazard. Vayikra is a term of chiba, of love, and that's why God opens the book of Vayikra. That's why Vayikra opens like that. Bamidbar, what's Bamidbar? That's a much longer count of the Jewish people. Boring, right? And over again, you know, this between 20, and it says the exact same wording, like over and over again. And the mountain, the Reuben, between 20 and 60, called Yosei Tzava, Lisiva Thomas, this thousand, and then it adds them all up, like, you know, it's, so why does it do that? God loves it. Like, Lahavdil, people, they love their money, they count. So that's why Bamidbar opens up with the count, because God loves us, and he counts us all the time. And Dvarim, what's Dvarim? Dvarim is God also loves us. Sometimes when you love somebody, a parent loves a child. The parent has to rebuke a child. You know, when the other kid is misbehaving, I don't care. I'm not going to get involved. It's not my problem. I get involved when I misbehave, when my kids misbehave. So God has to rebuke the Jewish people. So Eileh Dvarim, that first verse in Dvarim is very unclear. It makes about, you know, 10 different places. What in the world is Moshe here or there? He's all over the place. So Rashi has this famous comment that each one of these places, the Zahav, is a reference to the Chet, the Egel HaZahav, and Chatrot, the Meraglim. Each name of place is reminiscent. They even used a nickname sometimes. It's just a word that Jewish people would understand. This is where we sin. This is after we be better. We're about to enter the land of Israel. That's what the book of Dvarim is all about, enter into the land of Israel. So therefore, we have God has to rebuke it, but he doesn't want to, you know, bang the hammer over our head, very softly, very nicely. So that's how Rashi opens up each one of the five books of the Chumash. Basically, Rashi's interpreting that the term Shira is the notion of God's love of the Jewish people. The Torah is a Shira, is a love poem between God, and God and the Jewish people have a covenantal relationship with the Jewish people. Now, it's interesting. I just want to You know, I'll mention, I was just talking to the Masbergs. They had the pleasure of teaching their son last year at Chat. So a couple of years ago, when I was just the high school in Toronto, the largest, you know, community high school in North America. So I remember I was teaching a grade 10 class, and I mentioned, it was the beginning of the year, and I mentioned the Sarita May Tshuva. And most of the kids from Chat don't come from such observant homes. There's a wide range of knowledge, observance, whatever. So I mentioned, you know, what does a Sarita May Tshuva mean? So one of the kids said the 10 days of answering Sarita May Tshuva. And then the kid said, well, what's the question? In other words, if it's a Sarita May Tshuva, that's not, we normally don't interpret that. Like we say tshuva is repentance, but a tshuva is an answer. So I instinctively said, so what's the question? And for the first time in my life, it just instinctively hit me. You know what a Sarita May Tshuva is? It's an answer to a question. Well, what the question is, it's the first question in the Torah. What's the first question in the Torah? Anybody want to? You can write it in the chat box. What's the first question in the Torah?
Ayeka.
Excellent. You guys are great. Ayeka. God says, man, where are you? Now, of course, God knows where man is. So I said, but what's God saying? Where are you not physically, but where are you spiritually? Where are you morally? So the first question God asks man is Ayeka. So I said, that's what the Aseret Yemei Tshuva is about. The Aseret Yemei Tshuva is God asks us the question, where are we? Where are we going? And you know what? I actually wrote up a whole Dvar Torah based on this insight of a one of the kids in my class in grade 10. She had no idea that she gave me this insight that I had never thought of in my life. But what the Talmud says, you learn the most from our students. Mi Talmidai Yoter Mi Kulam. So I think in many ways that defines what the Torah is. It's God's asking man where he is. But you know, Ayeka, and we do this on Tisha B'Av, Ayeka has another meaning. What's the other meaning of Ayeka? Remember, there are no vowels in the Torah. And that's the notion of Ayeka can be read as Eko. Where is God? Eko, you mean one of the keynote we say on Tisha B'Av, God, what happened to Ko Amar Hashem? And all the times in the Torah where it was, this is what God says. God promised this, God promised that. Eko, God, where are you? Where is the promise that you did? Why are we suffering so much? So Ayeka is God's question to man, and Eko is man's question back to God. We ask God where he is, and that's Avraham Avinu. That's Avraham Avinu challenging God. In other words, it's a covenantal relationship. It's a dual relationship. And I think in many ways, that first question of the Torah, always the beginning sets the tone for everything. That's any good book and anything, the beginning sets up the major themes, the major concepts of the book. And that's what's going on here in the major question. So the Torah is the book describing the relationship, the covenantal relationship between God and the Jewish people. Now, let me talk a little bit about God and the non-Jewish people, because the truth of the matter is that may not have been the original plan of the Torah. What do I mean by that? So, you know, how many, the Torah takes place over 26 generations, right? From Adam to Moshe is 26 generations. That's we say on Shabbos morning, Gam Hodu L'Hashem Ki Tov Ki Li Olam Chasto, that God in his great mercy let the world endure for 26 generations, even though there wasn't a Torah. That's how the Medrash understands why there are 26 Ki Li Olam Chasto. God is very kind, because really the Torah, Yom HaShishi, the Torah was created, or the world was created. The Torah is the blueprint of the world. We've created to give the world. So without the Torah, why do we have a world? So we didn't need the world. So God is very merciful. 26 generations. I have to look this up and figure out. It has to tie into the idea that the Medrash says, if I'm not mistaken, that God, a lot of people know this Medrash, right? That God created many worlds before this world. That's the people who are into science and Torah sometimes like to use this one. You know, how could the world is so old, but it's only 5781, whatever. So you say, yeah, but the Medrash said God created many worlds. So that's billions of years, whatever. Okay. If people are happy with that, okay. So the Medrash says that God created 974 worlds. It's like a funny number. 974 worlds before this one. So obviously the 974 worlds and the 26 generations, to man, that's 1,000. Okay, that already makes some sense. But God did not create the Jewish people. God created humanity. And I said, if the Torah, if a good book in the first chapter sets up the main themes and the main ideas of the book, so the I would argue that the first and the overarching message of the Torah, the that Torah sets us up right at the beginning, is not maybe a little bit God is the creator of the universe, but that if you don't accept that, the whole Torah is not going to mean anything to you. Not that much. The idea that man is created in the image of God, that we are godly. That's the culmination of chapter one, the 6 days or six, you know, stages of creation, whatever you want to call it. So man is the culmination of creation. So chapter one is written to tell us man is created in the image of God, but it's man who's created in the image of God. Man is not created as a Jew. Menachem Liebtag, I hear this from Rabbi Liebtag first. He'll be starting, of course, a series on Sunday and by Cheney. But you look, and this is the way he understood what Sefer Bereshit, the entire Sefer Bereshit, is about. God wanted a covenantal relationship with man, with Adam, with mankind, and not Jews. But you know what? It didn't work very well. Right away, the next chapter, Adam and Chava, they're in Gan Eden, doesn't work. They're fighting. They're jealous. They want more. God says, "Eat everything." Right? You always ask people, "What's the first command of the Torah?" Right? So, what's the first command of the Torah? You guys are doing well so far. You're batting 100%. What's the first command of the Torah? So most
don't,
people
don't eat from
don't eat the fruit. Yes. Yeah, so maybe. So if I'm a nice guy, I'll give you a 7 out of 10. Maybe a 7.5 out of 10. What is really the first command? I don't know. Maybe it's not a command. The first command is to eat from
enjoy everything. But
exactly. The command is to eat the fruit. Eat everything. One fruit, don't eat. It's very important. In other words, mikol eitz hagan tochal, except that one fruit. It's very important. But anyways, so man blows it. And by the end of the first, what we call Parsha Bereshit, you know, the invention of the rabbis to divide the Torah into 54, you know, parshiot, by the end of Parsha Bereshit, God wants to destroy the world. And of course, it's Noah, a non-Jew, who saves the world, right? The simple reading of the Torah, without Noah, that's it. We wouldn't be here. Noah saved the whole world. We're all B'nai Noah, right? So man blows it. So God created the world, he creates a being to be in his image, to be like God. And he says, have children like me. I created you. You create other people like you. Man's like God. And we all know that Talmud says there are three partners in our creation, our parents and God. And we work very godly where that's what we are. We imitate God. So that was God's plan. It didn't work very well. So he had to start again. So he started with Noah. That didn't work so well either. Noach is a great guy. Maybe at the end, if we have time, we'll talk about him for a couple minutes. But it doesn't work so well, Migdal Babel. And, man is not so great. But what's God going to do? He's going to wipe out the whole world again. It's not going to work. It's not going to... He tried that once. It didn't work. So he goes to plan C. What's plan C? You have a dying business. Things not going well. So you can't change everybody. What do you change? You fired the coach, right? Often doesn't work, but you can't change all the players. You can change the leader of the players. You can change the general manager or the coach. So God says, you know what? I can't destroy the world. I need a new general manager. I need somebody to pick out who's a really good guy. And I'm going to make my relationship with him. And hopefully one day he'll be an Or LaGoyim. He'll create a great nation that's going to be for other people. But right now, plan A and B didn't work. Three strikes and you're out. We don't want to go there. Plan C, so he chooses Abraham. And the first 11 chapters of the book are to tell us why we get to Avraham Avinu. I'll mention the end, I get every day in my email, 5 from this publisher and that publisher, all the new books on Bereshit, the beginning of the year, buy all these great books. So always a lot of interesting books. So there are a couple of books I really like to recommend. So one of them is Zvi Grumet's book, put out by Maggie. Hold on, here. Right here, Genesis, it's called. I think it's a fantastic book, going through Sefer Bereshit. And his introduction is, he was once asked many years ago to give a class on Bereshit. And the person who invited him said, you know, you'll start at chapter 12. You started off from, well, who needs all that other stuff? All those names, you know, he was 900 years in Ada. Who needs all that stuff? All the boring stuff. It's meaningless. We want to teach our young children or adults, the Jewish people. We don't want to learn about Adam. We want to learn about Abraham. And he said, of course, he can't teach. No, if he's teaching Bereishit, you have to start at the beginning. I mean, to me, that's like it's heresy. What do you mean? God puts this in the Torah. Like, God put the, when people skip parts of the Torah, like, oh, it's not important. What do you mean it's not important? If God puts that at the beginning of the Torah, like, you don't skip the beginning of the book. You know, you come 10 minutes late, you miss a lot. You can't open up the book at page, you know, in the 12th chapter of the book. So, but the goal of the, or one of the goals of the first 11 chapters is to tell us why we need chapter 12. Why do we need Abraham? And then Rabbi Liebtag says the rest of the Chumash, the rest of Sefer Reishit, is to figure out who's going to be Jewish. Who's going to be Jewish? So Abraham's going to be Jewish. Now God says, I'm picking Abraham because he's going to teach his children staka u'mishpat. So right there, the Torah is giving us what are the key roles of a Jew. Staka u'mishpat, righteousness and justice. That's what a Jew has to do. Teach our descent, our children. That's what it says in chapter 18 in the Chumash. It's right there. We often don't notice these verses by storm near the. So I know that Avram's a really great guy. He's going to teach his children, but he doesn't have any children. So clearly, Avram thinks Lot is going to be his the future of the Jewish people. And that's why he takes Lot with him. You know, they move to Israel and he schleps along his nephew and he's very concerned with his nephew. He loves his nephew dearly. And at a certain point, it dawns upon him that his nephew doesn't have what it takes, right? His nephew moves to Sodom because he likes the money. He can make a lot of money. That's what it says. Remember, Sodom is like Egypt, right? That's what it says in the Torah. Sodom reminds, he looks at, wow, the grass, it's so, the economy in here is great, right? Fertile land. And that's, so Lot and Abram, no, it's going to be, so it's going to, okay, Yishmael will be the future of the Jewish people. Why not? Abram loves the famous Rashi, Kachna bincha yechidcha sherhapte et Yitzchak, take your son, your only son, the one you love. So Abram says, I love Yishmael, he's my son, I love, he's the only one. Yitzchak, so God had to tell him Yitzchak, whatever, you know. That doesn't have to mean the literal, really what happened, but that's how our rabbis are understanding what's going on here in the Chumash. So no, it's not going to be Yishmael. So it's Yitzchak. Okay. Yitzchak has two children. So he thinks Esav is going to be the future of the Jewish people. Rivka thinks, or to put it as Rav Shimshon from Hirsch, I think he thinks both Yitzchak and Yaakov will continue on. That, in other words, his idea was we need Esav and Yaakov. We need a Yaakov type. We need the Yoshev Olim, the nice, pure, the yeshiva bach or whatever. And we need an Esav. We need a man of the world. He didn't think Yaakov had what it took to be in the world. Yaakov that didn't have it. Yaakov learned very quickly. He got it too much. He learned the trickery and thievery. And he learned all those things a little bit too well. But that was Yitzchak's view. And they had a fight, you know, Yitzchak and Rivka, who's it going to be? And okay. So the Parsha Tolda teaches us that, you know, Yitzchak is going to be the future of the Jewish people. No, then we come to Yaakov. I mean, Yaakov is going to be the future. No, Yaakov has a lot of children. Yaakov's got a lot of children. So who's it going to be? So probably the brothers think that Yosef, in other words, if my father, my grandfather was only one, so Yosef is going to be the only one. I mean, at some point in history, if you want to build a nation, you have to have more than one kid who carries on the legacy, but nobody knows when that's going to happen. So when Yosef has his dreams and bowing down, so probably the brothers understood the dream is to say, just like Esau was rejected and Yishmael was rejected before him, they're going to be rejected. And the brother said, what, are you crazy? We're not going to be rejected. We're going to be part of the Jewish people. And then the book ends, the reconciliation of the 12 tribes, and they're all going to be Jewish. Some will sin, we'll do this, but we're in. Everybody who's a descendant of the 12 tribes is in the Jewish people. That's Sefer Bereishit, right? They're five. I said an introduction to Torah, right? There are five books in Torah. Why isn't there one book in the Torah? And what do you mean there are five books in Torah? And according to one view, there are seven books in the Torah. According to one view in the Gemara, we wouldn't call it a Chumash. Then we'd call it a Sheva. I don't know. That doesn't sound right. What's the part? I don't know. Let's learn Sheva. Because the court, you know, the backward nuns on Vayehi bin So Aharon in the beginning of Bamidbar there in Balotcha, when they were right before the sin of the Meraglim. So you have the Vayehi bin So is It's kind of moving the ark by Even Saw It Run by Yomer Moshe. We're going to go into Israel. That's its own book. It's a fascinating idea. Again, not for now, but according to one view in the Talmud, that's its own separate book. And so you got Bamidbar is really three books, up to Vayhi Bin Soh, and after Vayhi Bin Soh. So there's seven books in the Torah, which makes a lot of sense because seven is the magic number of the Bible. Seven is the number of Shabbat. And I mentioned before, seven is an invented number, right? There are 29 days in the month because it takes the moon 29 and a half days to go around the earth. There are 365 days in a solar year because it takes the earth 365 days to go around the sun. There's no reason to be 7 days in a week. That's the Torah's magic use of the number seven throughout Chumash. We've discussed on another occasion the importance of the number seven. So it would make sense there would be seven books in the Chumash. But okay, we assume there are five. But each book is independent. They're connected, of course. And Bereishit and Shmot are the most connected because it's Be'ele Shmot and the Netziv, same Netziv we talked about on poetry, says because the purpose of Bereishit is to get the Shmot. In other words, the purpose of the Torah, we said, the first 26 generations, is to get to that covenantal relationship. So God's plan was to have a covenantal relationship with everybody. Didn't work. So God's plan is to have a covenantal relationship with one people, the Jewish people. Okay, but we don't know who are the Jewish people, who's going to accept the Jewish people. So it takes us to 50 chapters of Sefer Bereishit to find out. But that's is the prelude. The Bereishit is only an introduction. The main scenes in Shmot, when we have Kabbalah Torah, okay, we have to go through slavery for another year. Why we had to go through slavery in order to get the Torah. So it's Ve'ele Shmot. Bereishit is really a continuation of Shmot. That's how the Netziv writes in his introduction to the beginning of Shmot. So that's basically what Sefer Bereishit is winning, who's going to be the Jewish people. Livnat also discusses it's the giving of the land of Israel, Zerah, and the seed and the land of the Jewish people. But basically, God's relationship was meant to be with everybody, and he has a relationship through Noah. But it's not the same covenantal relationship. I'll just point out one other example of where you see that, you know, Lot has an opportunity, Esav had an opportunity, like Yishmael, they could have been, Lot could have been part of the Jewish people. He blew it, so to speak. So I always love this, you know, on Rosh Hashanah, those who were in Shul on Rosh Hashanah, so we read the second day, the Akedah. What a powerful story, okay. Somebody will talk about it in a few weeks, I hope, maybe. Okay, then what is the Torah, how does the Akedah end? How does the laning end? It's such a anticlimactic laning. We read about, Vayihi acharei hadvarim ha'ela, it was after these things, Vayu God l'Avram, and Avram got
the birth of Rivka.
Yeah, so that's what Rashi says, it's the birth of Rivka. But you know what? The Torah could have said it other ways. The Torah doesn't tell us about the birth of Sarah. It doesn't tell us about, like, it's a little bit, yes, I know Rashi says that, and that's fine. But why does it mention everybody else? It mentions
12, birth of 12 kids, no?
Right. Nachor is 12 kids. Yeah, who else is 12 kids?
Yaakov.
Now, also, you know how many, it says in the Torah, his kids are, I mean, 12 sons, whatever, okay. Lenachor Achicha. At Utz Becharo Buz Achiv Kumuel Avi Aram Keshet Pildash Yidla Ubetuel Yaladet Rivka. Fine. Shmone. So also 12 sons and one daughter, like Leah, like 12 Yaakov. I mean Dina, like Yaakov has 12 sons and Dina. Shmone Eidel Yadam Milka Upilak Sho. He had a concubine, and the concubine had four children. Wow, isn't that cool? You know, I know somebody who had 12 sons and a daughter. And eight children with his wives and four children with a concubine. So the Torah puts this right after the Akedah. What's the Torah doing here, right? The Akedah is that moment, that intimacy where Avraham proves that he'll sacrifice everything for God. I mean, that's a very difficult parsha. Obviously, it's not our discussion now. So that's the intimacy. And the Torah is telling us, you know what? Nachor, you could have had it too. And said, Nachor had the exact same setup for Yaakov, but whatever, it wasn't going to be. So for the book of Bereishit is God's creating man, not Jews, to create a covenantal relationship. And by the end of the book, that covenantal relationship is narrowed down to a small, very slice of the population. But of course, we're all B'Tselem Elohim. We don't take away from the Elohim. Rav Soloveitchik beautifully pointed out that there are four couples buried in Marat HaMachpelah, not just Avraham and Sarah, and Yitzchak and Rivka and Yaakov and Leah, of course, not Yaakov and Rachel, but Adam and Chava are also, according to the, you know, our tradition, Adam and Eve are also buried in Marat HaMachpelah. And Rav Soloveitchik pointed out, because that's our humanity. You can't have the Jewish people without our concern for the human race. We're part of the human race. So you can't have Avraham and Sarah divorced from Adam and Chava. We have the concern for the world. That's, of course, we talked about that a few weeks ago. Nisan and Tishrei, the dual calendar. Nisan is the uniquely Jewish experiences, the miracles, the Pesach. And Tishrei is the natural world. And the Jew lives in both worlds. It's funny, I remember it's an aside, The Chacham Tzvi, I think, or Tzvi Ashkenazi, he's the 1600s, and lived in Amsterdam a little bit. The father of Rav Yaakov Emden, who was an extremely colorful personality, more colorful than most. A lot of these, he was super colorful, but his father has a tshuva. It's funny tshuva. You know, you have these like responsa. Can you count the golem towards a minion? You know, the Maharal made a golem. We won't get into that. Right there. I don't even know, how do you translate a golem into English? A robot, like Jaime on Get Smart, you know, remember, for those, you know, our generation, you know, remember him? So, you know, I don't know, you create a not real person. So can the golem, you know, the Maharal's golem that was invented by what's his name? Yudala Rosenberg, right? You know, Schneer Lyman points out the golem, Yudala Rosenberg, who translated the Zohar into Hebrew, he wrote children's stories. So it's a part of the thing. He didn't make it, he didn't mean it for people to believe it. He just wrote a story he made up, like for kids, parents to read to their kids at nighttime. So he made up the Maharal's golem. And somehow it became, people accepted it. He's Mordechai Richter's grandfather, for those who live in Canada know who that is. Anyways, that's not important. But the Chacham Tzvi has a tshuva, you count the golem towards a minion. So he says, well, the problem is the golem isn't a human being. So before you can talk about counting someone as a human being, you have to, for a minion, he has to be a human being. Then if it's a human being, it says, is he Jewish? Can you count him towards a minion? In other words, the idea is that our humanity has to come before our Jewishness. And that's why they're the first 11 chapters in the Chumash also, to teach us all these messages. But then the covenantal relationship is God and the Jewish people. But God's love, or God's relationship, does incorporate everybody. Okay, so that's a little poetry and the book and what's the purpose of Bereishit. I want to talk about a couple other things. The Torah, as I like to say, it is a very ambiguous book. It's frustrating. It's part of being a poem, you know. Why can't the Torah talk straight? Like, the Torah has to talk so, like, I can't figure out what in the world it means. So I want to give you one example. I had the tremendous pleasure when I was in Grus. I told you the year in Grus, and we davened the Michlala on the first Friday night. So Nechama Leibowitz, this was in the 80s, and we had the pleasure of having Nechama Leibowitz as a teacher, really the greatest pedagogue you can imagine. Knew everything. The word, you know, just an amazing woman. So people know her from her books, but if you have her every week as a teacher, I mean, and she was a tough teacher. You came to class, she told us, you come to class every week or you don't come to class. Like, this is not a country club here. We couldn't tape her class. She didn't, that's a tragedy, I would say, today. We don't have any recordings of her shiurim. She refused to allow her classes to be recorded. Bahar Sinai Aloha, you tape recorders. And you know what? Pedagogically, it's not the same thing when you're in the car listening to a shiur as it is with the Chumash open, and oy vai voy, if you didn't bring a Bereishit Shmot Mikra Kedolot, you were finished, you know? So yeah, homework, whatever. Great, so she introduced us. So I'll just give one example from this week's Parsha, Bereishit, about the ambiguity of the Torah. So the second question, I think it's the second, maybe it's not the second question. After the first one, I don't count anymore. So Cain kills Hevel. Right, so we'll talk about two things here. So God asked Cain, "Where's your brother? Right, what happened?" So Hashomer Achianofi, the whole discussion there. So God says, "I'm going to punish you. You're going to have to work the land." So then Cain says, "Vayomer Cain el Hashem." So Cain says to God, Now, the problem is, I don't know how to read it, because that's the whole debate here. Gadol, he says three words. Gadol Avoni means so. Anybody want to translate? Gadol Avoni means so. So Gadol Avoni means so. Gadol, is my sin too great to bear? So that's how Rashi said. In other words, what if God says, you're going to punish you? So God says, well, my God, what are you getting so upset about? What I did, I killed a little, who cares? Gadol Avoni means so. Beat me up, Rashi says. What? Atanoteno, you run the whole world and you're worried about some little guy here, what he does. What did I do so terrible? That's Rashi. The Ramban says, quotes Rashi, says Rashi's based on a medrash, but that's not the pshat. Kain said, he bowed his head and he said, my sin is too great to bear. It's not a question, it's a statement. Now, obviously, this is a totally, like Rashi and Ramban, like you can't get more opposite. 180 degrees. Either Kain did tshuva, he felt terrible. He says, my sin is too great to bear. I deserve more punishment. Or he said to God, get out of here. I didn't do anything so terrible. Now, and I remember how Nechama told us, what, you don't think Rashi knew like what the Ramban and Ramban know Rashi? Of course, the Torah did this on purpose because the Torah couldn't care less what if Kain the truth or not. I mean, maybe I was saying it hard. I don't think the Torah, because the Torah is not written. The Torah is not a history book. That's just kind of what the Torah is. The Torah is not a history book. The Torah couldn't care less about what happened. I remember Nechama used to tell us, the Torah doesn't tell us who went shopping and who cooked. Well, I guess it does tell us who cooked by Abraham and Sarah, sort of, but that's because it's part of the story. But it doesn't tell us who took out the garbage and when they went to bed. It doesn't even tell us how Abraham discovered God. Not in the Torah. Obviously not so important. You know why? Because the Torah told us how Ephraim discovered God. That's what we'd all do. And you know what? What works for Ephraim may not work for us. Everybody has to discover God on their own. So we're introduced to Ephraim at 75 years. Yes, in the Medrash, but it's a Medrash. You have to distinguish between what's in the Midrash and what's in the Pshat of the Chumash. The Torah, it's always more what's in the Torah, what's not in the Torah. But the Torah here, it's in the Torah, but we don't know how to read it. We don't know that Kain's say Gadol Avoni means so with his head down, or you know, he fluffed it off. So the Torah is doing that on purpose because the Torah wants us to understand the story both ways. Both ways are important. And it doesn't matter for Kain, but it matters for us. Or let's take the beginning of next week's Parsha, probably the most famous Rashi in Chumash. Noach is Sadiq Tamim Haya B'dorotav. Noach was a righteous man in his generations. So, you know, I remember the first time when I had just graduated YU, I think. I may know, it was when I was in YU. I was still in Yeshiva University, and I went to my uncle's house, who lived on the west side, for Shabbos, and we davened at the Jewish Center. I davened at the Jewish Center, 86th Street. And Isaac Bernstein, Alav HaShalom, was the rabbi. He was the rabbi between Norman Lamb and J.J. Schechter. He was the rabbi there. He passed away, a young man. I remember he spoke on Parshat Noach, and he was a British and very formal, and he spoke, and the sermons are advertised like the week in advance, like on the billboard. You know, you walk by, like the rabbi's speech will be at 11 a.m. on this topic in defense of Noah. Like everybody picks on Noah. You know, what Noah, what did he do wrong? Like, let's defend him. The Torah says Noah is tzaddik. So it's a famous Rashi. Was he righteous? He was greater than, well, however you understand, was he even greater than Abraham, even in his generation? Can you imagine? But had he lived in the generation of Abraham, it'd be even more amazing. He was unbelievable. Nah, he was, compared to everybody else, he was righteous. He wasn't such a great guy. So that's the famous debate that Rashi quotes. Now, before I get there, by the way, what's the pshat? That's a drasha. That's an extra, however you translate the word drasha. That's an extra level of interpretation. What's the simple meaning of the text? Noach is tzaddik tamim b'dorotav. It's very simple, but I don't know, in schools, they don't teach this way. You have to learn Chumash before Rashi, then you can learn Chumash with Rashi. Rashi learned Chumash initially without Rashi, you know? But anyway, so you know what it means? Noach lived for 18 generations. No other human being lived in 18 generations. Look it up. It's in the Chumash. You know all the chronology tables? Noach is the first person born after Adam dies. That's why he's called Noach, right? You'll be cursed, the land, right? Noach's born in the year 1056, I believe, like from creation. Adam dies in 930, right? He's the first person recorded. Obviously, there were other people born, but he's the first person that the Chumash records as being born. So he's born, he's living already with people from generation three. And of course, the famous Rashi, the Mabul can't start till Metushelach dies. He lives, by the way, when Rashi said, had he lived in the time of Abraham? Well, you know, let me tell you a little bit of a secret. He did live in the time of Abraham. He was, and it's very easy to remember, 58, Noach, Nunchet, the Gematria. Noach was 50, Abraham was 58 years old when Noach died. Just do the calculation in the Chumash, right? The famous thing, right? Abram was born, for all the Zionists here, which I assume is most of us, you know, if you add up the years, Abram was born in the year 1948. It's not the same 1948, you know, CE, but it's just a beautiful whatever you want to make of it. You can make nothing of it, you can make a lot of it. But if you add up all the years, Abram was born in the year 1948, and Noah dies in the year 2006 or whatever it is, it's 58 years later. So for 58 years, did they know each other? It's fascinating to think about it. If Abraham is one who seeks out God, you would think he would seek out Noah. Like I have no idea. The Chumash isn't a thriller. It's not interested in telling us these things. It couldn't care less about these things, right? So the pshat is Noah lived with Dorotah for 18 generations. Noah was Eitzadik. That's what the pasuk means. Rashi expects you to know that. Then Rashi's adding an additional layer of meaning. Was he really greater than Abraham or lesser or this relative? Now, why? Because both are, I don't care. I don't know about Noah, like personally, but that's an important message for all of us. How do we judge ourselves relatively? How do we interact with our community? So the Torah is very vague on purpose. Who sold Yosef, right? You know, if you look, Rashbam and Rashi, we're all taught in kindergarten, the brothers sold Yosef. If you look in the Chumash, the simple meaning, because the Torah says, and he, you know, you say, who does the he refer to? This, the Rashbam, and the simple meaning, it refers to the Midyanim, or the Ishmaelim, though, I forget which one, who passed by, you know what? And then it's an even more powerful message, because Yosef said, you sold me here. It doesn't matter if they physically sold him, they were responsible for the sale. In other words, but the Torah leaves it purposely ambiguous who sold him. So I'll say one other, this is not exactly an ambiguity, but it's something, well, I guess it is a little bit, within Rashi's methodology of learning, right? So Cain kills Hevel. Why does Cain kill Hevel? The Torah doesn't tell us. What does the Torah tell us? Vayomer Cain el Hevel achiv.
And Vayetan basadeh.
And they're in the field. Now, what's missing? What did they say to him? By Yomer Kain El Hevel. And Kain said to his brothers, and they were in the field, by Yakam Kain El Hevel Barakir, and he got up and he killed him. Doesn't say what he said. You know why? Because it doesn't matter. The Torah couldn't care. What do you mean? He killed his brother. The Torah's not interested. Just like, by the way, when the brothers throw Yosef into the pit, the Torah doesn't tell us what Yosef said. 22 years later, when Yosef reveals himself, he says, oh, you know, you threw me in the pit. And I was yelling and screaming and crying, and you couldn't care less. You couldn't care. Hey, oh, I didn't know that. The Torah, because when the Torah brothers saw, the Torah is interested in telling us different things. I remember Hanukkah pointed out, it's so callous. What do the brothers do, whatever, when they throw him into the pit? What's the next thing they do?
They have lunch.
They go out to have sushi and barbecue and have a nice time. They threw their brother in the pit and they went to eat lunch. The Torah's not telling us they went to eat lunch. The Torah's telling us the callousness of what they did, right? The Torah couldn't care less what they ate for lunch, right? So here, the Torah doesn't tell us what he says. So Rashi's obviously bothered. So Rashi said, okay, it doesn't matter. He looked for an excuse to create a fight. Yeah, we all do that. If we want to pick a fight, you'll find a reason to pick a fight, right? The hockey players, you know they're going to go into a fight and they don't need a reason. They just look for a reason. Right? So, Nichnasimo b'divrei riv. He started a fight with him. He picked a fight. Umatzali kolel, and okay, and through the fight, okay, he killed him. Okay. V'yesh b'zeh mitrashe agada. Rashi says there are many mitrashim about this, achzei yishuvo shel mikra. However, what I tell you is what the simple meaning. Remember, Rashi claims he doesn't quote midrashim unless it's to understand the simple meaning of the text. That's for another shiur. But so Rashi says, you know what? They're nice midrashim, and the medrash gives you all these reasons why he killed him. But you know what? It doesn't matter. That's not what the verse means. That's what the medrash. Now, Rashi doesn't even tell you what the medrash says. Like, you know, it's sort of, he whets your appetite. There's midrashim here, but you know, you want to go look it up. So Nechama looks it up, of course. So what does it say in the Medrash? Why they, you know, it's actually in her book, you know, in the famous book on her studies in Bereshit. So she quotes, the Medrash has three reasons, three opinions why he killed them. So the first opinion is they were fighting over the land. You know, this is my land, your land, you know, they were fighting. That's the first one, reason. The second reason is they were fighting over where the Beit HaMikdash is going to be built. God's going to, in my land, it's a different type of fight. Or the third reason, they were fighting over Chava, whatever that means exactly. Fighting over women, over love. So what is the Medrash saying? The Medrash doesn't have a clue why, what kind and have a fight about. The Medrash couldn't care less. The Medrash is telling us, what are the three things mankind fights about? So we fight about land, we fight about religion, and we fight on sex. That's what people fight about, love and religion and all the wars in the world, like land and religion, the mixture, right? That's the Medrash. So it's very nice, very beautiful, but Rashi's not interested in telling us that. Rashi's just telling you, it doesn't really matter what he said. So that's a very important style of the Torah. To, you know, that the Torah puts things unclear, and that's very, Rashi does this all the time. Rashi, where he'll quote a Medrash without quoting the Medrash. He wants to, in other words, Rashi wants you to know there's something important there. You should look it up, but it's not my methodology to talk about these things, because I only talk about the Pshat in the Chumash. Okay, so that's another thing about Rashi's ambiguity. If nobody answers the phone, and the last thing I'll say is the Torah is really, in many ways, is the editorial page of the newspaper. I'm not getting into the whole discussion now, you know, that's the new style of book. Yeah, how important it is to understand the ancient Near East, to understand the Bible. Obviously, I think it adds a lot. But that was, you know, many people eschew that approach. How can you, who cares? The Bible is totally independent. But it's clear that there are many, we're enriched when we understand the Bible in the context, like any book. You have to know the context and when it was written, how it was written. The Rambam is the most famous one, contextually, who does that, right? The sacrifices are not really ideal, but in the time that the Torah was given, it was impossible to create a religion without sacrifices. We know how controversial many of these views of the Rambam are, but Rambam does say it. I mentioned earlier that some people say the parts of the Torah are quote-unquote fiction. I know that's a strong word. It's the Rambam who says that. The Rambam is the great rationalist, didn't believe three angels came to Avram. It was a dream, and Yaakov, the fight with the Tsar, was in a dream. It was image. It didn't really happen. Because it doesn't have to happen, because the point of the Torah is not historical ideas. Of course, then very dang, how far do you carry that, right? There are rabbis, I remember what one of the conservative rabbis, about, I don't know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, gave a speech in California how he doesn't necessarily believe the Exodus happened, but it doesn't really matter. And of course, you know, people criticized him. It was on the front page of the New York Times, his speech. I always say, how many rabbis get their sermons printed on the front page of the New York Times? But when a rabbi gets up in front of 3,000 people on Rosh Hashanah and he says, you know, he doesn't know if the Exodus really happened. But the truth of the matter, his point, and I'm not here to discuss, yes, that's the whole thing, but the point is he's making the Torah in a sense even stronger. In other words, he's just developing this theme to an area that's most traditional people consider too far to carry it. In other words, how far do you carry it? The Rambam carried it here. He was heavily criticized. So he carried it a step further. Okay, that it didn't happen. It's an image and the message is important. The message is important, whatever. So, you have to understand the context in which the Torah is given. So the Torah is an editorial comment. In other words, the Torah clearly is coming to wean ourselves away, to wean the Jewish people away. I know very often people are uncomfortable with this explanation because it sort of seems to, I don't think it does, but it if it's misused or misunderstood, it seems to sort of put the Torah too much in a historical context, and therefore it sort of takes away from the eternity of the Torah. I don't think the two are contradictory. But the idea that the Torah is a product of its place, and that's what some people say. Like, I don't know, you know, the Torah couldn't write about evolution. That's because people before Darwin, they wouldn't know what they're talking about. Bereshit, God created them. Like, it wouldn't make any sense. The Torah had to speak in a language that people understood. So, and the examples given, you know, all the animals and farming, and, you know, because that was the society which they live in. Our challenge is, how do we apply all the rules of the farmer to a lawyer, and on Wall Street, on Bay Street, and, you know, in the hospital and the boardroom? How do we apply the rules given with Peya, Leket? So that's our challenge, to take the context of the Torah and put it into modern times. But when the Torah talks on vicarious punishment, like lo yum tu avod abanim, because that was very common in the time of the Torah, or the notion of treating the stranger, mishpat achad yelachem uloger, the stranger has to be treated equal. You know, we live in a, at least some of the people here, how we treat immigrants, you know, how the Torah says, how we have to treat the stranger 100% equal to everybody else. The notion of Shabbat was a revolutionary concept. So many of the concepts of the Torah are really, I would say, like editorial or a critique of the society around them, that you can only understand if you know the society around. Okay, one last comment, and then we'll do a quick review. And I would say, if I want to sum up the Torah maybe in one sentence, and after Simchat Torah, is Adam. We started with Adam. And Adam has also a very material type of, but that's how he was created, the material of the earth, from the Adama. You come from the Adama, you go to the Adama. Adam is a very earthly existence. That's what we are. We're very godly, but we're also very earthly. So at the beginning of the Torah, we're Adam. How does the Torah end? V'zot ha-baracha she'birach Moshe Isha Elohim epnei Israel. It's the only time in the Torah Moshe is referred to as Isha Elohim. At this last day of his life. In other words, you read the entire Torah. In other words, I think the Torah is saying the goal of the Torah is to take us from an Adam, from Isha Adama, to Isha Elohim, to someone who develops that covenantal relationship, who lives up to that covenantal relationship. And everything in the middle, everything from the creation of Adam till the death of Moshe, is tell us, how do we make ourselves from Isha Adama to Isha Elohim? That's really what the Torah is doing. And Bereishit introduces us to the Isha Adama, who's created B'Tselem Elohim. And at the end of the Torah, we have Moshe Rabbeinu, who was the one who more than anybody else, exemplified that Isha Elohim, and he lived up to that. So that's some point. There's a lot, obviously, we didn't discuss. Topic here, topic there. There's so much, especially Bereishit, everything, but obviously these parts you have so much more. So just to very, very quickly review, and then I'll see if there were any questions. We discussed what is the Torah? So we said the Torah is a Shira. It describes itself as a Shira, the mitzvah to write the entire Torah. We said that the Netziv understand that as a poem. The Torah has features of poetry, but meltable interpretation that stands the test of time, reading between the lines, weird language. So that's the Torah as a poem. Then we discussed it's a song, a love song, and how Rashi, each one of the five books, becomes a way to describe that love between God and the Jewish people. And God asked man, Ayeka, where are you? That's the fundamental question, where are we? But we ask God, Eko, it's the same letters, just to put different vowels. And then we discussed the Torah was initially meant for everybody. God has a relationship with the whole world, and perhaps it could have gone that way, but we struck out, you know, twice. It didn't work, so God had to go to plan C, but the could have been Lot, it could have been Nahor and his 12 children, etc. The Torah is very ambiguous because the Torah is not interested in history. The Torah is interested in morality and our lessons for us. So it presents the ways that you can interpret the same story in more than one way, on purpose. And in many, many ways, Rashi does the same thing. The Torah often doesn't tell us because it's not important for the Torah to tell us. So when the rabbis tell us, the rabbis are taking the Torah and applying it to their generation. Then we discuss the Torah as an editorial page, commenting on society. And the ultimate goal of the Torah is that we should become Ish Elohim, that we should become men of God, moving from Adam. So that's basically a little bit introduction. If you have any comments or questions or criticism, that's fine. I see everybody writes to me privately. Okay. Is how should man be made? Man should be created such that man can follow the Torah. Yeah, somebody asked me, man can be made. When the Medrash says that God looked in the Torah and created the world, istakel baraito bara alma. What the Torah, in other words, I said how the Torah predates the world, sort of. or the 974 generations, whatever that God kept, the waited 26 generations. So the idea is that the Torah is the blueprint of the world, which means we can keep the Torah. Sometimes it's hard. But if God looks in the Torah and creates the Torah, that means the Torah is part of the natural, or it's not like unnatural to keep the Torah. That's, I think, what the rabbis mean. He stuck up a right to Ubara Alma. Okay, somebody asked me, we do skip some of the commentaries at the beginning of the Torah. I mean, when we people skip, the Rashbam was sent to Ibn Ezra. Yeah, there's, okay, that's a whole other talk. Read Mark Shapiro's book on censorship. Listen, it's unfortunate. I think the truth, I think Torah is really, really powerful, and we don't have to live in a cocoon, and you know, it's okay. Yes, we have, over the ages, we have all kinds of amazing comments, you know, things like that. Yeah, people don't study. I mean, they skip this. Okay, that's what can you do? The word also, Vayikra, no, Vayikra there doesn't mean, in other words, it's not the and into Shmot. I don't think so. It's not quite the same thing as Ve'ela Shmot. Maybe it's Vayikra is any call, but there the commentaries don't put the Vav, like Vav HaChibur or whatever. They don't put it together. I'm not really sure, but I hear what you're saying. But when I said the Elishmud and Bereshit. Okay. Any other questions? Speak up. If you didn't like anything I said, please let me know. Any questions? That's the Seder. It's very quiet, you know, like, okay. I like when people argue with me, you know. And anyways, okay, this Sunday we're going to start. I swear. Yeah, sure.
When you were talking about God creating humanity first, mm-hmm. before Jews, so yeah. does this relate to the idea of Hashem offering the Torah to the other nations who refused it?
Oh, that's an interesting question. In other words, that's probably part of the same theme. Again, it's probably not literal, you know, the Midrash. In other words, the idea is that the other nations also had the opportunity to get the Torah, and they turned it down. Very good. Correct. It's the same idea. I think the Medrash is picking up on this idea that Lot could have been and Yishmael could have been. And the Medrash is saying, okay, even, and God gave them a second chance at Sinai. God went to all the nations and said, you know, right. And the nation said, no, of course it didn't really happen. I mean, I don't know what that means exactly, but again, the Medrash is imparting ideas.
I'm still thinking about God having his eyes on the land of Israel.
Yeah.
Right.
So, of course, listen, if you want to talk a little philosophy here, that's the famous comment of the Ravid on the Rambam. You know, the Rambam is so radical in so many areas, but the Rambam says that all that is anthropomorphism, that a Jew who believes that God is any bodily parts is a heretic. I mean, not only is he wrong, Rambam says, not only is he a heretic, he loses his share in the world to come. If you believe God has eyes, the Rambam claims, you lose your share in the world to come. Well, that's pretty, whoa. But it's all over the place that God has a body. So the Ravid gets upset at the Rambam. He says, Mr. Rambam, excuse me here. I mean, he says such a sharp comment. He says, Gedolim betovim mimcha, people who are greater and better than you. You Rambam, what do you think you know? People who are much greater than you thought that God had a body according to what it says in the Torah, the Midrashim. Now, all the commentators point that is the Ravid agreed with the Rambam that God didn't have a body. But the Ravid got so upset. Why do you call somebody a heretic? I mean, okay, so he's wrong. He made a mistake. It's a pretty easy mistake to make. It's all over the place. Now, we have been living for 800 years under the influence of the Rambam. And the Rambam's influence in this area was so strong that anybody who thinks God has a body, we think is crazy. But in the Middle Ages, it wasn't a crazy thought at all. So that's the Rambam. So the Rambam would say God's eyes on the land of Israel is just, obviously, it's a metaphor. But other people, God has eyes. So we're created in God's image. Well, what does that mean? God has eyes, we have eyes. And I mean, it's hard for us to think that way because the Rambam won this one, really, like hands down. And we consider it like outside of the pale. The question is, who are these other people? And people have written today, you know, disagree with the Rambam. But, you know, there's all kinds of wild views. But it means God is focused on Israel. That the God, I don't know what that means. I don't know anything about God. That's how the Rambam says we can't understand anything about God. It's all negative theology. We can't understand what God is, and we can't understand anything about God. But the gap is too great. But whatever, God's eyes on Israel means that there's something special about the land of Israel. And that's why he gave it to the Jewish people. And that's how the Torah begins, right? You know, that's so the Rambam says, whatever it means.
The crossroads.
Yeah. All right. Any other questions?
You're saying he gave them the land of Israel. as well as the Torah, or the mutually
agreed. Yeah, in other words, they went together. The way Rashi's saying it is, God gave the land of Israel to the people who gave the Torah, because that's his special people, and God, Israel is his special. I mean, listen, that was the early Zionists, you know, the right. What did they say? What the secular Zionists say, a people without a people without a land for a land without a people, you know, whatever. Or the credo of religious Zionism. What is it? Am Yisrael, Be'eret Yisrael, Al Pi Torat Yisrael. You know, the nation of Israel and the land of Israel according to the Torah of Israel. Okay, that was sort of the religious Zionist manifesto.
Yeah. It makes sense. Now I understand.
Okay, have a good night.
Thank you.